Welcome to Night School, taking a stab at the Middle Ages.
A podcast devoted to medieval history and culture, and the occasional bad pun.
I'm Becca, bringing you everything related to medieval religion and church history.
And I'm Claire, talking about medieval literature and history.
Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're here with Peter from medievalist.net to talk about running the website and also discuss Anglo-Norman kings and their treatment of prisoners of war.
Peter Konieczny is the co-founder of medievalist.net and editor of Medieval Warfare magazine. Peter holds a master's degree in history from the University of Toronto. He has studied and presented papers on a wide range of topics in the area of medieval military history and has been working to spread knowledge about the Middle Ages online for over 15 years. Becca, do you want to start off with the first question?
Sure. Yeah, thank you again so much for joining us. We're really excited to have you on the show today. And we just wanted to see if you could start us off with a little bit on why you were first interested in medieval studies and starting medievalist.net, as well as, you know, why you think it's important to make the medieval world accessible to the broader public.
First of all, thanks so much for having me, as a guest. I really appreciate it. I got interested in medieval studies like in the 1990s, just as I was into university, fell in love with it and, started going to conferences, things like that, kind of thought of having a more of an academic career in medieval studies, but I decided I became a librarian instead. As I was doing that, I still wanted to maintain some presence in medieval studies. And I also was kind of experiencing where I hear all these great papers. I go to conferences. I read the ones in the journals, like Speculum and things like that. And I look at how the general public kind of perceived Middle Ages and I see, wow, what a big difference. And, there's all these great things that are going on, but people just don't know about it. So I started getting involved in the online part as a kind of way of bridging being a librarian and being a medieval historian. And first thing I wound up doing was becoming the website editor for De Re Militari, the Society for Medieval Military History. And that was fun. I started that in 2001. And with only a little bit of the blessing of the society, I wound up creating a fairly big website at the time, where we were getting republishing articles and primary sources and being this kind of resource that people could access. And way back in 2001, not many people could access academic articles and things like that. So at a time it was really welcome. And so I kept on going into projects related to medieval studies and outreach. And it's something I kind of felt passionate about. It wound up leading to creating medievalist.net about 12 years ago, so which is crazy, I think. And the whole idea for that is how do we be a site that brings everybody that's interested in the Middle Ages to find like something for them. So if you're just entering, want to learn a bit about it, there's things for you. If you want to go more in depth, we can provide you the ways and things like that. And so far people have been liking it. So
that's awesome. Well, I know that Rebecca and I are really appreciative of medievalist.net. We reference it a lot. And your website really does seem to cover a wide range of geographic regions and a lot of diverse cultures. And that's also something that we're very committed to representing in our own podcast in our upcoming episodes. And so we were wondering how medievalist.net works to address more of a global Middle Ages.
It's certainly an issue top of mind for me and having a kind of a much wider outlook. I came into history not like through, say, medieval England or anything like that. My first interest was like in Chinese history. So it never kind of dawned on me that we should limit our reach and we should limit our stories. And I think it's very important that, you're able to kind of tell stories that are from different places, because I think different cultures, different backgrounds, a lot of people that kind of get interested in history can be sometimes very nationalistic and like, I just want to learn about, my little corner of the medieval world. and kind of everyone around me it doesn't matter or is considered, you know, somewhat hostile to you, right? If you kind of just look at that kind of nationalistic bent. So I've always wanted to kind of make it so that we have authors that are writing from different regions of the world and kind of telling stories and getting people hooked that way into like what's being learned about the wider world. So, and there's plenty of great scholarship that just doesn't get covered. So
yeah, definitely. We really appreciate that about medievalist.net. And like Claire said, that's something we want to continue working on for our own podcast. But today we are going to discuss medieval England because you have done a lot of research in that area, and because you said your next issue of Medieval Warfare is going to talk about prisoners of war and English kings. So we know the year 1066 is pivotal for the history of medieval England. So we were wondering if you could discuss for listeners, you know, why this year and the Battle of Hastings is really crucial for our discussion today on Anglo-Norman kings and prisoners.
You know, 1066, the Battle of Hastings, Norman conquest, I think a lot of your listeners will know what that is and things like that. I think people don't appreciate, though, is how much a fundamental change it was to kind of structures of government and how England becomes part of this kind of greater kind of European and French kind of mindset that we have. So like, you know, they kind of, England's was much more drawn to like the Norse world than Scandinavia up to 1066. That was the kind of more influence. And now you're having this kind of where you have Normans and kind of war ethos kind of being imposed into that, but it makes big changes. And the England becomes part of, you know, these ideas of what kind of burgeoning ideas of chivalry and kingship and falling under, like, obviously, like, you know, William and his sons have a very different view of, you know, what it is to be a ruler and organizing kingdoms. So it's very interesting. And, like, you know, and prisoners of war is just like one of those little aspects of it where you have like these, some of the new ideas of what a king should, you know, how he should treat his subjects. And in this case, like, we're looking in medieval warfare. I'm doing this article. I really wanted to actually write about it for a long time. Is, you know, how English kings dealt with prisoners of war in kind of the late 11th to, like, you know, 14th centuries.
Yeah, and so how does the king's treatment of prisoners of war, maybe you could go into some of the different aspects of that treatment, and how does their treatment kind of teach us about the general power of England's kings that was going on between the 11th and 14th centuries?
Yeah, I think the most common notion people might have is that if a person gets captured on the battlefield, the opposing knight takes them, take him back to his castle and ransom him, and it will be that kind of situation. And that's something you actually see more in the 14th and 15th centuries. But if you're looking back in the 12th century, in that era, is very much like any prisoners of war are really just the king's prisoners. That goes from like the highest ranks to even like the lowly crossbowmen. Like, you know, there's this great story, kind of like comparison is like at the Battle of Neville's Cross, the King of the Scots gets captured, and the person who takes him, he's kind of a, you know, mid-level knight, and he basically is able to secure for himself a huge payday from the king before he turns over the prisoner. And he actually, you know, he goes to London himself. You know, he refuses to give the captive over until everything is kind of settled, and he becomes this, you know, wealthy guy, right? And you compare that to like this kind of late 12th century battle where another Scottish king gets captured. Henry II. Hears about this victory and the Scottish king is captured, and he basically orders the guy who has him to bring him at once, or he's going to kill him. So, you know, there's so kings have like immensely. They as soon as they're kind of captured, the king takes them. He will organize where they're put. So we have lots of kind of records, especially like, you know, Henry II and John saying, all right, we're going to send these prisoners over to you. You got to take care of them. If they ever escape, you're going to get fined a huge amount. And you even have like, you know, like a lot of situations where the kings will keep people in captivity for the rest of their lives. Like the most kind of famous one is Henry I captures his brother, Robert Curthouse, in battle and keeps him in prison for 20, 30 years until Robert dies. Like he just won't release him because he kind of fears him going back and having a power center. And you have like situations where the kings are mutilating captives, you know, imposing huge fines. I don't think ever executing a prisoner, but like basically like of a high ranking anyways, but they it's very much their level, and the people that actually do the capturing, and these aren't battles where necessarily the king is there, these are any kind of fighting that's going on that involves the king. So
I saw an article on, it was on some minor maybe like news site, because the US just yesterday enacted a death penalty on that white supremacist for the first time in like I think it was 17 years or something. But I saw some article and it was like, it kind of related it to like the medieval treatments, but it was very vague and just kind of, you know, one of those assumptions that it makes this big dichotomy between medieval bad, modern good. Do you know what I mean? So it's just interesting to kind of combat that and say like, oh, actually, no, they weren't executed. They were treated in other ways. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm always kind of, you know, searching for is to explain often how, you know, people look at medieval views and automatically they kind of sense as this, the more barbaric, more, you know, painful and torture, like that's all those tropes kind of get thrown into the Middle Ages. And, you know, we don't realize society is today in many ways much more violent than in the Middle Ages. And you know, they may have had like different ways of doing things, but not necessarily worse or like more evil, you know, as things like that. So, you know, those are things I always, you know, the Middle Ages is always, kind of a bugbear for, you know, like saying, you know, how civilized we are today, you know, but back then they were just terrible people. So.
Yeah. I always have this vision whenever a misconception comes up of when I was a little child going to medieval times as like a 6-year-old. And the first thing you see when you walk in is this just like dark hole that you have to walk through. And then on the other side is like a guillotine and then all of these other like torture mechanisms and stuff. Yeah. And it's just interesting to think about. I mean, grant you, this was in the middle of Dallas, Texas, and like 2005, but it's just funny the way that certain things in popular culture today get it very wrong. But
although you were saying kind of how Anglo-Norman kings still did have this immense control and mentioning some of the methods like fines and mutilation and things like that, so we were also wondering then, did this have like a reciprocal effect? Like were other rulers practicing similar treatment of their prisoners of war, or did these kings then have any trade-offs for having this immense control? If you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Like one of the most fascinating things I found out is, okay, if this period where the kings have all this control, they're also responsible for the captives on their own side. And so you actually get a lot of encounters where kings are having to make peace agreements and truces to arrange for prisoner exchanges. So like we have the situations that, and this is very true, especially with say fightings against the King of France. So the King of England, King of France are at war for a couple of years. They sign a peace agreement. And part of that is we're going to send back all our prisoners. both sides. So, and you wind up getting like thousands of men coming back. You also have, you know, kings doing ransoming of people. Richard first ransoms a whole garrison of his troops that have to surrender. He gives them a castle for them. So like the kings seem to have a responsibility to their own men. But by the 14th century, this changes where like you don't see Edward III doing anything to, you know, help anyone that's captured on his side. There's very little evidence of like him sending money to, you know, help for a ransom payment or anything like that, or arranging for exchanges. You don't see that. And then you see the trade-off is that at that point, you know, if you capture a person, you literally, it's your, you know, meal ticket. But then if you get captured, you don't have anyone to rely on. So.
Right. And then we also always like to bring like perceptions of medieval women into our discussion. And so we were kind of wondering if there's any documentation of there being female prisoners of war in Anglo-Norman prisons. And if so, were these women treated any differently than male prisoners?
We have like a couple of instances of women being held by kings for long periods, in part as not necessarily prisoners of war, but as kind of captives to bargaining chips, things like that. You know, like the most famous kind of female prisoner of war is Joan of Arc. Her treatment doesn't seem to be any, you know, different. Like she winds up getting executed. There's no basically any law that she has to be treated differently or even compassionately or as a prisoner of war, like we might have like in today's laws. You know, there's expediency and political expediency kind of outweighs everything in these kind of situations. You know, there's only a few instances that we have, so.
Is this kind of emphasis on studying women prisoners as well? Is this more of a recent thing that scholars are studying, or if you have any thoughts on that?
You know, yeah, like, you know, well, first of all, prisoners of war is one of those aspects is the only thing really studied, you know, by say like this generation of historians. It's, you know, I think if you go back beyond say 1980s, I doubt you'll find like more than one article about the treatment of prisoners of war, let alone a book. And that's kind of like, it's kind of the part of the interesting things about the Middle Ages where, and current scholarship is now how diverse everyone's become where, you know, we look at different topics and we can focus on ideas of chivalry and, you know, from logistics to morality in warfare to just overall kind of strategy where, you know, if you go back, say, you know, 50 years, medieval military history was often just the domain of like former soldiers who wanted, you know, say, hey, this is how a battle was fought. Here were the tactics, here are the strategy. And that's all we're going to say. But you know, like I get with medieval warfare that like I can be able to, you know, talk about, you know, how prisoners of war get treated like in various cultures, and the kind of the military ethos of the time and how it changes. So
yeah, that's awesome. And I think this is a great place to wrap up. So thank you again for joining us today to talk about medieval warfare. And we hope our listeners really enjoyed this episode as much as we did.
Join us next week as we chat with Dr. Matthew Lynch about Sufism.